Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Cows, Gusty Renegade, and for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of racism. Today's date, Monday, February 29th, 2016. So I have been told, wrapping up Black History Month. Hopefully people got constructive information from the broadcast carried out this February. The broadcast for today, I was reflecting, like, we have been doing quite a little bit of Virginia history over the first 2 months of 2016. The information that we had on the school closings in Farmville, and certainly there's a ton of information on Virginia in the American Slave Coast that we cover with Thomas Jefferson, Sally Hemings, all of that. Even The Half Has Never Been Told, Edward Baptist, the book that we just finished up. Always great. I say that all the time. If you're going to study racism, you can just start with wherever you happen to live at. They probably have quite a bit of rich history that you can learn a lot about and share with other people that you are around. So lots of Virginia history on the cows to start this year. Broadcast for today, saw information about this brand new book just a few weeks back. Shared it with some of the folks on the program and several people. I know we have VA listeners, but just people in general thought it would be great to hear about this book and hear directly from the author. The book is Forsaken, and it details a black female teenager in Virginia, 1912. She was given the death penalty, electrocuted. Just incredible case to get some of the details about what happened. I, as a Virginia native, University of Virginia graduate, had never heard of Virginia Christian, didn't know anything about her until I read this book, heard the author talking about it. Really glad we could get him on the program to get some of the details and kind of review why he chose to write a novel about this case, a significant piece of Virginia history, in my opinion. Our guest, likewise, a University of Virginia alumnus, a prolific writer. He has about a half century of dedicating his time and energy to writing, publishing, even though this is his first novel. Great to have him on the program. He now resides in North Carolina. Great to get some of his perspectives on these events. Joining us live, Mr. Ross Howell, Jr. Mr. Howell, are you with us, sir?
I sure am. Gus, thank you.
For sure. Thank you for sharing a bit of your Monday evening with us. Before we get started digging into your book, is there anything that you think it would be helpful for our listeners to know about who you are, the work you do?
Well, I think you pretty much covered it. I actually haven't devoted, I sort of started out in a writing career some years ago and then got involved in marketing and then in the book publishing. And so I sort of turned away from writing for some time, and it's really only in about the last 6 or 7 years that I came back to it and started working on some short stories and getting a few of them published. And then in 2010, I was doing some research, and that's when I came across the story of Virginia Christian, the only female juvenile ever executed in the history of the Commonwealth of Virginia, including colonial days.
Wow. Really looking forward to getting through your book. I'm going to try and see if we can cover as much as possible and make some time for questions from our listening audience as well. For folks, this probably, I'm sure, is their first time hearing about your book. For some of our listeners, they haven't seen you. You are a white man, is that correct?
I am. Yes, I am.
I know. This program, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. I use them as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think that definition is accurate? Do you think such a system exists?
I think it's accurate, and I think it exists. I think sadly this period of time, 1912 in Virginia, was one of the worst periods for the growth of this type of system.
Right on. I guess really quick before we get into the book, well, actually it is in the book, the audio that we started the program with, and in case anyone is confused, that is the, I think it's the state song Emeritus for the state of Virginia, Carry Me Back to Old Virginia. It does come up in the book. We have talked about it before. If folks recall, I think some months back last year, Doug Wilder, first black governor of Virginia, he talked about this was one of the things that he did when he was governor of Virginia, getting this song removed and the intense backlash that he got from white citizens in Virginia and saying, you know, how dare you? And this song is great. And what do you mean it's racist? There's no problem. Just any significance for the text that we're going to discuss and the, I can't even say former state song, the state song Emeritus?
Well, you know, I had the good fortune actually to meet Doug Wilder when I was still living in Virginia, and you spoke exactly right. Yeah, that was one of his achievements, was getting that song taken down. I don't know if they ever I don't know that they ever came up with a replacement for it. I think there were several options, but yeah, it was quite the controversy. You know, during and following his administration, yeah, and it is kind of, I don't know how long it's been since I've heard that, and you know, when you hear the lyrics, it's kind of hard to accept the fact that some people might think it wasn't racist. You know, it's just one of those things, I guess, that people, without understanding, you know, they can't seem to be very empathetic with the situation for other people.
Wow. Just, I think he said he saved many of the letters that he got, Doug Wilder, from white people who were furious about him saying, you know, we should take this, remove this as the state song, that this is not correct. I don't think it's a case of misunderstanding on the part of these white people. I just think that's dedication to racism, why they would be upset about removing this song. But I don't even remember hearing this song. This is not ancient history. I just want to make sure that's clear for listeners as well. When this song was removed as the state song, this is not like 1912, this is like 1970s, 1980s, when this stuff was going on, when they were having discussions.
I think it was in the 80s. Yeah, pretty sure it was in the 80s. Yeah. During the Wilder administration.
Not ancient history. Before
no, it isn't. It sure is.
Before we get to Forsaken, your novel, I've been trying to ask all of the white guests that we have come on the program. There was a non-white author. He wrote a piece about racism right at the end of 2014. And he was talking about racism. And he had a specific sentence where he says, white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism, but rarely are they pained enough. And just the first portion of the sentence where he says white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism. You're a white man. You've been around white people, I'm sure, a good chunk of your life. Based on your experience, your understanding of white people, do you think this is an accurate sentence that a significant portion of white people are sincerely, often sincerely and greatly pained by racism? Do you think that's a true statement?
I would say in response to that probably not enough white people give sufficient thought to the history of what African Americans have faced in this country, you know, really over four centuries now. I think some people take it into account, but I have to say overall probably most people don't understand the full measure of what happened here.
Just, I'm trying to just make sure I get a clear answer to the question. So just based on what you just said, do you think that the statement is true or false, that a sizable portion of white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism?
I guess it would depend on your measure of substantial. I do think I think that's a reasonably accurate statement. Maybe it's a little beyond the actuality of people. It's hard for me to speak for others.
Well, I'm not asking you to speak for others. I'm just asking you to make an observation just based on the white people that you've been around. I'm sure you hear them talking about things. You're over 60 years old, I believe. Just, you know, what your experience has been on the planet around white people, and if to you they seem to convey any sense of being often sincerely and greatly pained by racism.
I would not say often, no.
Okay. Great. Appreciate your response. Yeah. I think for people that have been listening, we've been asking this question for about a year now. We're about 50-50. Half of the white people have said no. Half of them have said yes. They do think that that statement is accurate. Although we have had a recent bevy of people saying yes, that they do think that statement is true for a while. Most of the white people had said no. They think that that is not accurate or representative of the white people that they've been around.
Yeah.
Moving to Virginia Christian, Forsaken. I want to kind of go through your novel and pick out some of the high points and questions that I have about all of this. But before we do that, I just think it would be helpful for listeners if you could just kind of give an overview of what happened in this case. Black teenager Virginia Christian killing her white employer, Ida Bellot. Can you just kind of set it up for our listeners?
Virginia Christian had hardly any education. She was, the only record I was able to find was that she had attended a school for black children from the age of 10 to the age of 13. And then somehow I was able to find out how her mother became paralyzed. And the family was so poor that they really needed for Virginia to work to contribute to family income. So she was pulled out of school and started washing clothes for Mrs. Bellot, who was the woman who was murdered. So Virginia started doing that when she was 13 years old. So she had washed clothes for Mrs. Bellot for, you know, a period of 3 years. In the course of that work, from time to time, Mrs. Bellot, who was a widow and had two daughters living at home with her, would accuse the nickname for Virginia Christian, they called her Virgie, accuse Virgie of stealing various articles. Sometimes it would be maybe a piece of clothing, something like that. And then, you know, not surprisingly, the article would show up. It had been misplaced somehow or other. And in March of 1912, Virginia had asked her mother, because of the way the widow had treated her, she'd ask her mother that she not have to work there anymore. And so she didn't go around on the day of the murder to wash clothes. The widow sent one, her younger daughter, to ask for Virgie at her home, that she said she needed her help at the house. And Virgie's mother convinced the girl to go against her wishes. And when she got there, the widow confronted her, saying that a locket had been stolen and that she was going to make big trouble for the girl if she didn't tell her where it was. Virgie once again denied taking the article, according to the confession that Virgie gave to a couple of newspaper men after her conviction. An altercation followed, and the widow woman broke some type of crockery on the girl, struck her with some type of, you know, fairly heavy crockery, and it shattered on the floor. They got in an altercation, and the widow was struck down, and ultimately strangled. And these were the crime scene gave evidence of a pretty violent struggle. And this was also the account of the murder as the girl herself gave it into the newspapers. What was unfortunate about her confession was that she was upset because she had two very, very capable African-American attorneys representing her, nonetheless, they felt it would not be a good idea for her to testify in her own defense. And so that was why she contacted or had the authorities contact the newspaper men to come in so that she could tell her side of the story. And at this time, you know, she had an appeal pending. So her attorneys were very upset that this had happened, that, you know, anyone had been allowed access to her. She had been convicted by a jury of her, quote, peers, unquote, that is a jury of 12 white men, property owners, women, of course. At this period, in 1912, it wasn't until 8 years later that even women would be granted to vote.
White women?
This case occurred about a decade after the Virginia Constitutional Convention of 1902, which was convened. The legislators stated very clearly on the floor of the House of Delegates of Virginia, convened to reduce the Negro vote. And so, of course, no African Americans would have served on any jury. The effect of the 1902 convention was to disfranchise a total of about, believe it or not, 60% of Virginians at the time lost the right to vote. And of that 60%, more than 70% of that number were African American. So the situation, obviously, as far as the jury went, and certainly as far as the social system went, was completely loaded against this young black girl, uneducated, pretty much alone. And she was found guilty in a half hour's time, according to the foreman of the jury. The 12 white men sat around the jury room for an additional half hour so that they felt that would be adequate time so that the court wouldn't feel that they had not given the case due consideration. She was sentenced to die in the electric chair and remained in custody in the Elizabeth City County Jail in Hampton, Virginia, until her custody was transferred to the state penitentiary in Richmond, Virginia, where at that time all executions were to be carried out. One of the big reasons for the big rush on the trial, I mean, she was arrested about an hour after the murder occurred. The coroner's inquest was convened the following morning because the mayor was fearful of mob violence. They were afraid that the black girl would be lynched. So one way of looking at it is that the Commonwealth of Virginia rushed to judgment and, in effect, lynched the girl in its own right in order to avoid this violence.
Context of white supremacy, stunning.
I think you have a line in the book that kind of sums it up. The main character, Charlie Mears, who's a white reporter who's talking to Virgie Christian during all of this, where his white editor says, "This is a Virginia jury of white men. They know what must be done." I thought that was chilling, succinct, right to the point about what was going to happen. And this whole course of event is done in a matter of months from the time that this happens in the spring of 1912 to the execution that took place that summer. This is pretty rapid succession that, you know, this is all wrapped up.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Why did you...
And actually, it would have gone faster had there not been a couple of reprieves. I mean, she would have... she was sentenced actually to die at shortly after she arrived at the prison in June.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to make this text fiction, even though this is based on, you know, a significant piece of Virginia history?
You know, Gus, I guess I've always been a fiction writer, so I was always kind of leaning that way, although when I started to find more and more historical information and photographs and that kind of thing, I thought about doing it as a piece of nonfiction. But what happened was, there's not, as far as the girl Virginia Christian goes, we don't know much about her. I mean, we know about her. She had a pretty large family. She was on the younger end of a string of children. About, I think there were 8 children in her family. We know that she used to scour the railroad tracks along at the Ceno station for coal that fell from the tender car, because that was how one of the witnesses who saw her leaving the house, that's how he recognized her, because he had seen her gathering coal, obviously to heat the house of her family. They were in really bad circumstances. I mean, when she was executed, her family didn't even have the funds to have her body transported back from Richmond to Hampton so she could be buried. So actually, a local undertaker in Hampton paid for the transfer of her remains back to Hampton and for her burial. Otherwise, her body would have been released to the Medical College of Virginia as a cadaver. So she lived in great poverty. As I say, we only know that she had at least 3 years schooling. She may have had no more than that. The only record we have of anything she might have said was her 2 words when she answered the court as to how she would plead. She pleaded not guilty, and then we have the record of her confession from one of the reporters, the one who I used as a narrator, Charlie Mears, where she describes what happened in the crime, and he transcribed it in her own vernacular. So we have only the one photograph of her that appears on the cover. I was never able to find any other images of her or of anyone in her family. And that picture was made the day she was taken into custody at the state penitentiary. So there wasn't much that we know about her. And if you were just to relate the facts as you know we've been doing here, I mean it's sad enough to think of this isolated child being electrocuted. But I thought if I could somehow bring her to life, to help people see and hear that here was a human being. And I have a scene in the book which is based on fact. It's the last meeting between Virginia Christian and Charlie Mears. Now, probably in reality, I mean, I don't know whether this meeting ever occurred, but the facts around the setting for that were real. This girl, 16-year-old girl, celebrated, if that's the right word, her birthday in a penitentiary cell that actually looked out on the electric chair chamber where she knew she would die the next morning. And I thought if I could somehow bring that historical fact to life, that people, it would be harder for people just to dismiss it, just to turn away. And so that's why I went ahead with the novel format. I used the fiction format. What I tried to do in the book is wherever I could find a historical record, I tried to make the historical record as accurate as I could in the book, but there were some places where the record is silent. And that's where I thought I would try to use fiction to make these people and these events real in a reader's mind.
What would your response be to people who would say, hey, this is a white man writing a fictional account of the execution of a black teenager where the main character is also a white man? What would your response be to say that, hey, something about that just seems very incorrect and shifting the focus away from the main character, who should be Virginia Christian, to Charlie Mears, this white reporter?
Yeah. I started out writing the book in third person. And it just kind of sounded like a history lesson. It just didn't sound like something that was alive. And so I realized that I felt like I needed a witness to the events. If I could find somebody who saw what happened, heard what happened, someone who would have access not only to Virginia Christian, but to the halls of power, even the governor's mansion, that I felt like I could make the story more authentic. And I realized when I had done so much research that I had found just such a person, and that was the character, the historical character, Charlie Mears. And Charlie Mears is unique in that he was the only white journalist who actually tried to intervene to save the girl's life. He twice wrote the governor of Virginia, who was, ironically enough, the last governor of Virginia who actually served in the Confederacy. Anyway, Charlie wrote two letters to Governor Mann explaining that he felt that the confession the girl gave showed clearly that there was no premeditation in her act, and that, you know, life imprisonment surely was sufficient punishment, but the state did not need to take her life. Of course, that fell on deaf ears. But to try to get to your question, I felt as a white person, I needed to use a white narrator, because as much as I can try to understand and experience what African Americans have felt and faced in this country, as much as I feel like I can understand that, I can only understand it up to a point. And I felt that by keeping a white narrator who basically was a witness, that would bring some authenticity to the words that I was writing that might not exist otherwise.
Interesting. I'll have to ponder on that for a second. Why did you start the book off? One of the first kind of pieces of authentic Virginia history that you give in this novel is the 19th century rebellion of Nat Turner. Why is that something that you started the book off with so that readers will have that in mind as they begin this novel?
Well, I put that in there to show a number of things. One of them was that there was this shadow of fear in Virginia among white people because basically they were outnumbered by the blacks that they had, victimized. And there was this pall of fear that was there. But I also wanted to show that when this rebellion occurred, the response among the whites was not to try to improve the situation at all, but to make the situation even more cruel. So as a result, over and above the fact that that they mutilated Nat Turner's body, that they used his body to make trinkets. But they also, because he had such a prodigious intellect and could quote passages of scripture verbatim, page after page, and conduct these magnificent oratories, these sermons, totally untrained. So their response to that was to say, all right, well, we're going to make it illegal for anyone to teach a slave to read. We're going to make it illegal to even give a slave a book, even the Bible. So the response to, or the way that this fear manifested itself early on, was to make the cruelty and the injustice even worse. So that when you fast forward to the end of the federal occupation of the South after the federal troops leave, that's when these Jim Crow laws start being passed. That's when these really cruel social structures begin to be put in place. Again, I would say all out of fear, this lingering fear, and really guilt for how white people had treated these African Americans from even, from before the large slave occupation of the South, but from colonial time. So I guess I wanted to try to show that this was a system that really had crept in even earlier than, just the period when we think of slavery, which is bad enough. I mean, it had crept in even earlier and then was suppressed basically by the federal occupation, and then boom, it just started unfolding all over again.
Going back to your previous response, if I understood correctly, where you said you felt that you as a white man writing this book about this black teenager, Virginia Christian, that was executed, that you felt that the only way you could do it authentically was to have the main character, the protagonist, being a white person, that you couldn't really speak authentically if you were going to write this and have the main character be a black person, because you felt it wouldn't be truthful in terms of your ability to represent what was happening in this story. To me, at least, there seems to be a lot of connections between you and Charlie Mears. Like, you both are writers, even though you're not a journalist, but both white men who are writing the rescued dogs. That ends up being a very prominent theme in the book. Charlie Mears going to rescue this dog, Lucky, and that ends up tying directly to racism, where there's some retribution around that. And you have on your bio where you have your rescued dogs in North Carolina, and even this alleged sympathy on the part of Mr. Mears for Virginia Christian, and him doing what he can with his writing to try to get her story out, and you doing the same thing. What was your response to that be?
Oh, I think I would have to say, yeah, I think there's quite a bit of me that is in Charlie Mears. I'd have to say he's at the end of the day, I think Charlie is a better, more courageous person than I could hope to be. He is idealistic. He tries to live his Christian ideals, and he gets into trouble for it. And yes, the dog, Lucky, is important. I saw him as kind of a metaphor, you would say, for how people had been treated. And then he had a period where he was free and taken care of and thriving, and then the system found a way to destroy him. And I think in my own case, I mean, I grew up in the mountains of Virginia, and you know, so I don't know what your experience was when you went off to UVA, I guess, but I mean, that was the first time I even knew something like a prep school existed, you know. And so I was, you know, this redneck kid from the mountains of Virginia, and a lot of people kind of looked down their noses at me, and I guess it's fair to say I resented that, and I felt that I was sometimes unfairly treated. So, but at the end of the day, I do think Charlie is a better person than I've been able to be. Certainly more courageous.
Fascinating. You have in the book, it reads, the murder of Miss Belote, the white woman that Virginia Christian was executed for killing. The murder of Mrs. Belote is deplored by Negroes, read a headline in the Daily Press. And you also included, you write that colored preachers from the pulpit called for a quick execution. Is this historically accurate? And what are your thoughts? If it is, can you speak to that?
You know, Gus, it is. Yeah, that is taken from actual newspaper accounts. The what I was trying to show with the Jim Crow system is that it also forced black people in many levels. Time and again, they were faced with just lousy opportunity. For example, the attorneys who represented Virginia Christian, George Fields and Thomas Newsom, both men were very successful attorneys. They had very successful practices. They had, in the case of Newsom, he actually founded and ran a newspaper for African-Americans in Newport News. And they had families. They had houses. They had all these things that they wanted to protect. And so for them, the best thing, sadly enough, was just to go on with their lives sort of under the radar. It was better for nothing to really stir up the system, you know, nothing to get attention focused on them. They didn't want attention focused on their daughters and sons, their sisters and wives. And that was the dilemma. That was where I think what probably motivated maybe some of these colored preachers who did, in fact, call for quick action against Virginia Christian. They wanted this problem to disappear because it posed such a massive, deadly problem for them socially and economically and even morally. So. You know, I think it's part and parcel, you know, of the argument, intellectual argument, between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. You know, where Du Bois demanded all the rights of all citizens for all black people, because that's what the Constitution specified. But, you know, Washington took the position that no, we'll be, you know, he was always accused of being an accommodationist. But Washington would say, no, we'll take what is given to us. We will, by our success, our longstanding success, we will demonstrate to the white man that we are deserving of all these rights. And I think that is echoed in the actions of, you know, these preachers of color when they were calling for this speedy action on Virginia Christian's case. In other words, let's just make this go away. Let's just make this go away. We'll continue living our lives. We'll move forward, and things will get better.
I had the distinct honor of talking to Darren Moten for about an hour. Wrote his dissertation, which you reference in your acknowledgement section, A Gruesome Warning to Black Girls, the August 16, 1912 execution of Virginia Christian. And he just a wealth of information and talking about this case. It was just really great to be able to speak to him this morning after I read your book. And I asked about this incident, and because I was trying to see, like, you know, what bits of this, because this is fiction. I generally do not like reading fiction, and particularly reading fiction about accurate, actual things that have happened, because it can be difficult to kind of disaggregate, you know, where the author has taken what they call poetic license and what is truthful. And so I asked him about this, and he said, yeah, that is true. And he said, but this could have been a Tulsa easily. This could have been a Rosewood easily, where if white people were not pleased with how they were going to handle this nigger woman, it could have just been, hey, we're going to go and kill 20, 30, 40, 50 black people because we're upset about how this has been happened. Or we just go snatch her out of the jail and do a lynching. And this sort of thing was happening all the time across the country, not just in the South, at this period in this part of the world. That you had black people who were saying, man, let's, you know, if we have to sacrifice her, okay, because we know the terrorist rage of whites, and it could end up backfiring on all of us, where large numbers of black people could end up suffering for this. And he said that should really be kept in mind when we think about this, even though he said it wasn't widespread. You didn't have tons of black people who were saying this sort of thing, but you did see some examples. This is historically accurate, where some black people were making these comments.
Oh, yeah. And you know, those, I don't remember the exact dates, but just not too long prior to this case, you know, it's ironic they would call them race riots, where basically what they were was white people going out and killing black people and burning their homes. Mm. That's what they were calling race riots. But, you know, we had the terrible one here in Wilmington, North Carolina, I think about 1896, and what there in Chicago, I think also there, yeah. Or not, it was somewhere in Illinois. It was not Chicago, but it was a town in Illinois where they had horrific instances of white people just, for whatever had set them off, just going out and, I mean, slaughtering black people. And so, yeah, that was a fear, a very real fear that people had, exactly as you said it, that, yeah, it might wind up being a lot worse than just a lynching of Virginia Christian. It might be that a mob got together and decided to burn down that part of Hampton where black people lived, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. What, you have a scene where the protagonist, Charlie Mears, white reporter, he's at his residence, and Maybelle, she's the help, if you will. She does the cleaning, cooking, that sort of thing. And they have a conversation where they have a disagreement where she has mispronounced the word contraband when she's talking about the end of the Civil War. And Charlie Mears corrects her. And she gets an attitude like, you know, wait a minute, are you just another one of these uppity white folks from Richmond? And they leave it at that. Like, what were you getting at in this scene?
Oh, what I wanted to say, that I saw Maybelle as a very strong individual who was not going to put up with a lot of lip from anybody, least of all a teenage white boy. And I think it was also a lesson for Charlie that he needed to learn some respect.
Fascinating. It's significant. I think you said you thought of Maybelle as being strong. I paid attention. The female characters, the way that they get described throughout the book, some of Mrs. Belote's children, Harriet and Sadie, the way that they are described, the way that Miss Belote gets described in detail when they find her body and talking about how small she was and, you know, she was full of vinegar and that sort of thing when they're talking about her. And then the way that some of the black females are described, there seems to be a pattern where not all, but a good portion of the black females in the book end up being compared to men. You write about Maybelle, that she was strong as a man. When you're talking about Red's mother, the same type of comparison, certainly Virgie Christian, where that just doesn't seem to be the case for any of the white women that are in the book, where they do not get masculinized in any way by their strength or the way that they carry themselves. But this does seem to happen. There seems to be a pattern of it, not with all of the black female characters, but it certainly seems to be the case, as I said, Maybelle and some of the other black females that are represented in the book. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you raise an interesting point. I think, historically, the descriptions of the widow, Mrs. Blood, I mean, she was a tiny, frail woman. I think her health was pretty bad. I mean, she was at the same height as Virgie, but she probably only weighed, I think one account said she probably weighed 90 pounds. The description of the crime scene, again, that's one of the things that might annoy you as a reader. The description of the crime scene is actually taken verbatim from the actual coroner's inquest. That was the coroner's description of the crime scene. The women, I think Harriet, again, like her mother, she is depicted as very fragile. When the coroner asked her in the inquest why she didn't go into the room to see where her mother might be, her response to that is, "Well, my heart just failed me." And that's actually a quote from the historical girl. So I saw her as being very fragile. I think there's one person, the mother actually of George Fields, Martha Ann Fields, who manages to get her children behind federal lines in 1863. She was an incredibly strong woman, both intellectually and emotionally. I mean, to pull off what she did, to suffer the things that she suffered, to and she, like Charlie, was a strong Christian, a devout Christian woman. I guess maybe on a subconscious level, I was just feeling that really for black women, you know, they sort of had to be strong. They had to be stronger than most women, just to survive psychically and emotionally day to day. I mean, when you think about let's take the very best outcome that could happen for Virginia Christian. Let's say by some miracle, her attorneys were able to get her case acquitted. What were her options? Her options would be to go back as a 16-year-old girl to this life of drudgery, you know, washing clothes, never having any education, probably someday raising her own family in poverty, in all likelihood. I mean, the options for women were not good, for black women were not good. And I think it would have taken a very special kind of strength and character just to survive day to day.
What would your response be, the pushback being that black female strength, it ends up not just being that they're strong, but they are less than a woman, this strength somehow ends up being evidence that they are not quite feminine in the way that we think of Mrs. Belode or Sadie or any of the white women that are presented in here, Mrs. Mann, the governor of wife of Governor Mann at the time. They're not feminine the way that we think of white women. They end up being thought of in a very masculine way, which can lead to them being treated in a very masculine way, even the way that Virginia Christian ends up being executed, that they end up being thought of as brutes in the same way that we would think of a male, that they are just not afforded the same protection and sensitivity that white women are given because their femininity is somehow masculinized.
I see what you're saying, and you know, in the descriptions, in the newspaper descriptions of Virginia Christian, you know, she's described as a negress, you know, as a negress, like something different from a human being. They often talk about her dark color and her blotchy skin, and the newspaper reports would describe her hair, you know, as being in little ringlets, you know, that it was, again, just anything to make her even seem like not only less than a woman, but less even than a human being. But I would try to say, in as far as the other black women go, I mean, for the hymns, again, having my own model, I mean, you know, I grew up on a farm in the mountains of Virginia, so my mother, you know, she did manual labor day in, day out, you know, washed clothes by hand, you know, milked her cows by hand, carried, you know, 5 gallon buckets of milk to a spring house where she strained it and put it in these 20 gallon pails and stored them in the spring house to keep cool. And then, on the mornings when the truck came to pick up the milk, she had to put those things in a wheelbarrow and carry them down to the road, which was, you know, a good quarter of a mile, in a hand barrel. So I guess really I used to, you know, as you get older, I think about all the things that my mother did for me, just the physical stamina that required. I mean, I remember her when I was a kid making biscuits from scratch every morning for me before I went to school. And again, washing, you know, she washed the clothes in the spring house, so she had to heat her water, you know, building a fire under this big kettle. So I guess I just always remembered her. She was a tiny little woman, but she was very strong. And I admired her for that. I feel guilty that I wasn't more appreciative of what her strength represented, and yet, to my mind, no, she wasn't a woman like, wasn't a female like her sisters who lived down in Roanoke, Virginia, and had bankers and doctors for husbands. She wasn't a female like those females, but she was always a female in my mind, always my mother in my mind.
Right.
So
I didn't want to belabor it. Just even some of these, and I understand what you're saying about the language that was used at the time. But some of these, where you're describing these other different black female characters in the book, these are your words. These are not quotes from the paper, what have you, where you're saying that, you know, this, as I said, Maybelle is strong as a man, or some of the other black females are tall as a woman. It's not the strength per se, but it's just them being masculinized in some way that, mm-hmm. you know, seems to be a pattern to me, not just with you, but across the board in terms of how black females are described, talked about, thought about, and it being to their detriment, where they somehow, they lose their not just their humanity, but their femininity as well is compromised. I wanted to also get in, you have a different anecdote that happens pretty close to when the initial killing happens, where I'll just read the quick passage from the book, where they're talking about this at the jail, where it's this black male has been accused of raping a white woman. You write, colored boy's in the house. Turns out he's the gardener. Neighbor lady decides to bring over some cornbread right out of the oven for supper. There he is, the colored boy, inside with the lawyer's 15-year-old girl. Girl starts screaming, says he broke open the door intending to have his way. Of course, he's a good-looking young buck. Now you and I know Charlie. And they go on from there. Is this accurate? Is this based on a historical record?
There was a young man charged with assault at about the same time, in Hampton, at about the same time as the Virginia Christian case. And as I'm recalling that actual case, the sheriff sort of managed to find some way to get him free because, in all likelihood, the girl had invited him in the house.
Wow. Wow. That another long-running pattern that also has led to quite a few Tulsas, Rosewoods, entire black towns being burned down,
yep.
and scores of
yep.
black people killed, slaughtered across the country as well. Let's see. This kind of comes up repeatedly throughout the text, where people are commenting on what impact black characters and white characters in the text are commenting on how this case is going to impact what they call race relations in the Commonwealth as a result of this. And one of the sentences in the book, it says, "How had Hampton kept good relations between the races before whatever happened with Virgie and Mrs. Belote? How would Hampton keep good relations after?" And I just, that is a fascinating way of conceptualizing this, race relations in an era where black people are not allowed to vote. And as you said, just all of these deliberate, systematic ways of stomping on and keeping black people in a state of poverty and ignorance and no education. That is an interesting way of describing this, race relations between white people and black people. What would your response to that be?
Yeah, unfortunately, that was the language used not only by whites, but also like with that group of black preachers, where they talked about, oh yes, it's important for us to maintain the good relations between the races, which, of course, at that time meant just what you said, complete subjugation economically and politically. And racially, yes, that's what in the white mind, that's what constituted good relations between the races, was the constant subjugation of one by the other. That was the god awful thing of Jim Crow.
I consistently on this program try to emphasize using the importance of using correct terms, because I still hear people use that term when they're talking about the massacre in Charleston, South Carolina, or any of the other incidents, Michael Brown, where they will say race relations. And I just consistently say that is not an accurate term. That is making it seem like this is a fight where the power is equal between two groups. And that simply is not the case. We're not talking about a spat between like the Hatfields and McCoys. We're talking about a just gargantuan power imbalance, white supremacy, call things what they, same thing like you said before, we're calling this a race riot. That's not what it is. This is white terrorism. This is just white people being able to go and slaughter huge numbers of black people with impunity. You have another very interesting passage. There were so many groups, and you kind of pull some of this out in the text. And again, when I spoke with Dr. Moten earlier today, he really emphasized how much publicity this case generated, which is kind of staggering that it really is not very well known now, but so many people got involved, even beyond the state of Virginia, in trying to comment and help Virginia Christian and see what they could do to try to save her life. People in Chicago, and particularly a lot of black journalists, NAACP representatives, National Association of Colored Women got involved. And you have a passage in the book where you're talking about Mary Church Terrell. She was a member of the National Association of Colored Women. Virginia Christian is talking to Charlie Mears, the white reporter, about Miss Terrell's visit while she was being held in custody, waiting to be executed. And Virginia Christian, she says, that high-toned woman, talking about Miss Terrell, that high-toned woman came waltzing in here in her button shoes and ruffles and feathers, wouldn't even sit down, afraid she'd get her dress dirty. She passed for white any day she wanted, Mr. Charlie. She ain't no negress like me. Eyes black as coal. She helped Virgie. Because of her, the governor granted the reprieve. Maybe he'll grant another. There's still time. Is this based in historical fact? And why did you include this?
It is based on historical fact. As it turned out, that summer in July, the national meeting of the National Association of Colored Women took place in Hampton, and so it was kind of a spontaneous thing where some of the women brought a motion to the floor that they should write a petition for the governor to spare this girl's life, because at that time she would have been executed, I think, right at the end of July. So Terrell did actually take the petition that was signed by, Darren showed me a copy of it. I mean, it's, you know, it has some of the leading women, African-American women from all over the country. I mean, one of the signatories that I remember is Maggie L. Walker, because she was so prominent in Richmond and in Virginia history. But Terrell did board the train, took the train to Richmond, presented the petition, had whatever, I don't know what exchange she actually had with the governor. She did meet the governor, and the governor did give her permission to visit Virginia Christian in her cell. To no avail. That scene, as far as Virgie's reaction to it, is, in this period, the difference in color among black people, you know, it's like that was used against them. And the fact that Virgie was a very dark African-American girl was one of the ways that she was victimized even further. I'm guessing you've seen pictures of Mary Church Terrell. I mean, she does look good. She looks like a woman who could pass as a white woman if she chose to. And happily, you know, she chose not to. She was proud of her race and wanted to protect her race.
Are there any, I mean, certainly there are no documents that this is what Virginia Christian said to Charlie Mears, or this was her?
Oh, no. No. And honestly, it's, I don't even know how likely it would have been that he would have been able to visit her in her cell. I mean, he certainly did in Hampton, but whether he would have been able to visit her in her penitentiary cell, I don't know for sure. I'm guessing he might have gained access as a newspaper man, but no, there's no record of him actually bringing a cake or meeting with her, trying to help her celebrate her birthday or anything like that. But the visit that he refers to from Mrs. Terrell, that is an historical fact.
Okay. That was when I spoke with Dr. Moten about that, and he said that certainly colorism has been, continues to be, 2016, a huge issue for black people, and that all is the product of white people, racist man, racist woman, what they have done to us. But he really emphasized in saying that, you know, even if we say, I mean, certainly this is not based on, this is not factual in terms of this conversation, what he said. And he said, even if we take it that, okay, maybe you have some of the black people that are in these different organizations or what have you, where, you know, they are in a better position. Maybe they have a few more nickels, a better bank account, better house or what have you than Virginia Christian or some of the black people that are a little bit worse off. They certainly did not have to be involved in this case. The National Association for Colored Women, they went to the governor, as you said. He said that, hey, they were responsible for getting this stay on this execution, where at least she got a little bit more time for them to try to work, that they really labored in earnest to try to save her life. The NAACP, they paid for a private investigator to try to get more information, to see if they could get, you know, more facts to try to help to get mm-hmm. her out. And particularly when I heard right. all that, and I said, wow, for a white author to take that sort of liberty in describing a black female who was working and doing all she could to try to save this black female's life, that's the sort of thing where I point out and see that, in my view, I think could be a white person practicing racism to write something that, in my view, kind of disparages really difficult work. I mean, you want to talk about putting it on the line. All of these people, Mary McLeod Bethune, she was also one of the people, as you said, it was kind of a who's who's list of, you know, black people at this time, the very early 20th century, who were involved in this case. Like, they were really putting a lot on the line, and to just kind of have a brief mention of her, and she's a really important figure, Mary Church Terrell, to have her kind of belittled as, you know, kind of an uppity Negro woman who didn't even want to sit down. Like, that just seems like I just don't understand why a liberty like that would have to be taken, particularly by a white man writing this book.
Um, I can't really answer that. I just saw it as something that could be a part of Virginia's feeling about her situation, that because of her dark color, that in the end, no matter who tried to help her, that it probably would not make a difference. I didn't mean to belittle Mary Terrell or certainly any of the efforts by any of the African Americans who tried to save Virginia Christian's life.
Hmm. Wow. Again, our guest author, Mr. Ross Howell Jr. Before we get a few of the questions from our listeners, you give more detail about what happened to Charlie Mears, the white reporter, in this case, and I guess retaliation that he faced from white people in Virginia who were not pleased about the articles that he was writing about Virginia Christian, that, you know, appeared to have some sort of concern and trying to say, hey, we shouldn't kill her. You know, let's you know, life in prison, something other than taking her life. And you write, they burn a cross in the yard where he lives, and the dog Lucky that we already talked about, he ends up being poisoned. Is that accurate? Did that happen? Was a cross burned in his yard? Dog killed?
No, that is invented.
Okay. And for what purpose?
To show the real danger that someone who in white society who might try to speak out on behalf of African Americans, that Jim Crow was a dangerous environment for them as well.
Hmm. Fascinating. It kind of continues. Even as I was reading, I was like, wow, the second half, or at least the last third of the book, I would say, after Virginia Christian has been executed, is kind of, I would almost say, exclusively kind of focused on Charlie Mears and kind of what happens to him. Some of this retaliation that he faces is kind of, I don't want to give the whole thing away, but I mean, the mutilation that he experiences, is that based in fact?
That is, sad to say, yeah, the Virginia colony for epileptics and feeble-minded is where for a period of time, the Commonwealth of Virginia performed sterilizations of both white and black people against their will. You could be characterized as feeble-minded if you just didn't have a job. These kinds of what happens to Charlie is something that did unfortunately happen to individuals. The mutilation of his friend Red, who is a mixed race boy, is something that was actually called for, believe it or not, or I'm sure you would believe it. It was called for by the regional associations of the American Medical Association in Virginia, where they thought that sterilizing a criminal of mixed race and cutting off his ears would be a way of identifying him when he was released back into free society. That was actually something that was advocated by some of the people in the American Medical Association in Virginia.
Mm, wow. I'm reminded of Elaine Riddick, because this was not just that you're in North Carolina. This was something that was done in quite a few states throughout the country as the eugenics movement gained prominence. We had her son on the program where she was forcibly sterilized, black female, after she had her first and only child in North Carolina. Matter of fact, they just had the recent big controversy about doing reparations for this. Was Charlie Mears, because in the book, unless I read miscorrectly, Charlie Mears was subjected to some sort of genital mutilation, the white reporter. Is that truthful? Did that happen?
That again is invented. It was the punishment meted out to him. That certainly could have happened, but no. To the historical, I have no historical record of that happening to him. Although it did happen to white children.
Got it. What would your response be to someone who reads this book? And like, I had never heard of Virginia Christian. I was born in Virginia, graduated from UVA, never heard her name mentioned in, you know, any of my classes, family. The first time I've ever heard about this case. And I'm assuming that a lot of folks, you know, reading your book, that's probably the case for them too, particularly people who don't reside in Virginia, who are, you know, who are significantly younger. To read an account like this, and even though you know up front, this is fiction, this is a novel, so certainly you know, as an author, you can take, as they call, poetic license in putting this story together that is based on fact. But when they read this and you get, you know, all of these incidents happening to this white guy who's, you know, the protagonist, and he's, you're seeming like he's empathizing with Virginia Christian and feeling bad about this and trying to do what he can to help her, and you know, getting this account that, oh man, they burn a cross in his yard and they kill his dog, and they end up, you know, clipping off his genitals later in the book, and all of this stuff, he gets kidnapped and everything, and reading all of this and not digging, not going to get Dr. Moten's thesis or getting other accounts of factual information that they could be greatly misled, particularly about the role of white people. And I would say it seems to me to be a common theme of this overly sympathetic white people. I think all the time we talk about slavery, it's like you got to emphasize John Brown and Harriet Beecher Stowe and really play up these well-meaning white people who cared a lot and helped to read this account and to get all of this, that you end up sympathizing with this character, Charlie Mears, where a lot of this stuff is just not true. You just made that up to, you know, construct this novel.
I'm not sure what you were asking me. What were you asking me, Gus?
What would your response be to people who say, hey, a lot of people could read this book and be confused and think that, hey, this is a well-meaning white guy, this Charlie Mears character that is, you know, based in fact, this was a real person, this white reporter. But all of these incidents that, you know, are not truthful, are not accurate, that did not happen, the cross being burned in the yard, the dog being killed, his genitals being mutilated towards the end of the book, these things not happening, that it could confuse readers and have them thinking that you had well-meaning white people who sacrificed so much in helping black people. That seems to be a common theme. How would you respond to people who are saying that's something, that those are liberties that should not be taken, or at least that those type of liberties should be, you know, criticized, called out, particularly from a white author?
I certainly didn't mean to confuse anyone. I think, you know, I can't recall this man's name, but there was a, you know, there were some writers, particularly in the Midwest, and I think also Kentucky, there were some journalists who wrote for some journals that, you know, in their own way, they tried to bring some sanity to the argument about, you know, the relationship, what African Americans represented in American tradition and American history. And, you know, I would say there certainly were some people who tried to be of assistance in their own way. I certainly don't think they would in any way supplant the activities of intellectual and political and religious leaders in the black community. There's no way that, you know, anyone could even imagine the kind of leadership, say, for white people that say the women of the National Association of Colored Women represented to their constituencies, or the intellectual leadership that, say, someone like Du Bois or James Weldon Johnson in the artistic community, in the writing community, There's no way, or even Booker T. Washington, for that matter, when you look at the very pragmatic things that he was able to achieve with the Tuskegee Institute and the growth of Hampton, what began as Hampton Normal School into Hampton Institute. I mean, all these achievements were, in this period, were realized by black people, not white people. I think what I hoped to show was that in some circles there was certainly some empathy for the situation, that there were people who did want to try to remedy it. And I guess I certainly don't want anybody to take any confusion away from the novel. What I hope people will take away from the novel is the you know, the empathy to understand situations for people other than, you know, ourselves, and to actually feel a strong resolve that we move forward, always honoring human rights and human dignity, especially. You know, what's, I mean, one of the very sad things about the Virginia Christian event is that her life somehow became very cheap in people's eyes. Just like somehow, you know, Tamir Rice's life in Cleveland became very cheap in people's eyes. And that shouldn't happen.
Wow. Just real quick before I get to some of the callers, after, like, latter portion of the book, when you have Charlie Mears, he's at the governor's mansion, and he's having this conversation with Governor Mann's wife, and they're talking about lots of things, the Virginia Christian case and racism in general, her views on the importance of, you know, Negroes knowing their place, like Uncle Wynn and his daughter who are working there, servants and what have you. She talks about, this is 1912, so I mean, this is not that far removed from formal slavery, white supremacy, Civil War, the period called Reconstruction. And she talks about, you know, the horrors of Reconstruction when we had jackanapes in the state legislature. And, oh my gosh, we've got these, you know, Negroes who are running, you know, the state. And I mean, this is horrible. White people have been displaced, and we've had to work so hard to get things back in order, and to have, you know, white rule and proper authority for what's supposed to happen. And it seems like lots of other white people that are around, they come in and endorse these views. How would you compare that to what is happening 2016 with Donald Trump looking like he is easily going to get the Republican nomination for the presidency, where it seems like there are a sizable number of white people who are voicing a similar sentiment that we have been subjected to 8 years of, you know, Negro domination with President Obama in the White House, and it's time to set things back in proper order with white people being, quote unquote, in charge of the country? Do you see any similarities? How would you respond to that?
I'm sad to say, Gus, yes, I do see similarities. And I just, one thing that I still really bothers me is, you know, when you hear somebody like Ted Nugent call the President of the United States a subhuman mongrel, he is using language which is straight from the racial superiority screeds of 1912 and following. And the really incredible part of all this is that in 1912, as bad as the situation was, in Virginia, it got even worse, because in 1924, was when the Commonwealth of Virginia passed its what became known as its racial purity laws. And those laws were in fact emulated by the Nazi administration in Germany in what they, the legislation that they sought to find, you know, there, in 1912, the language was here in the United States where intellectual leaders, white intellectual leaders, were talking about, quote, finding a final solution for the Negro problem, end quote. That's what they called it. And, of course, much is made of Hitler's search for the final solution for the Jewish problem in Europe. And these laws that were passed in Virginia, which were not ultimately recanted, the anti-miscegenation laws were not ultimately set aside until 1967 in the case of Loving versus Virginia, where a mixed-race marriage was disallowed by the Commonwealth of Virginia, and the Supreme Court finally said, no, these anti-miscegenation laws are unconstitutional. So beginning in 1912, as the power of this Jim Crow legislation became more and more powerful, it grew into these Racial Purity Acts of 1924 in Virginia. And that legislation was acknowledged by Nazi Germany as serving as the model for their legislation in the Third Reich. And my great fear is that people don't listen today enough to the language that is being used, because it is very dangerous. You know, I think sometimes we sort of want to think is like history is like a straight line. And, you know, we start off at one place, and little by little, things get better. And that's just the natural course of progress. But I think really history is much more like a pendulum, and it swings back and forth. So, you know, you hear it all the time with these commentators and so forth. They're talking about political correctness, you know, and how awful that is. You know, and, oh my goodness, people can't say what's on their mind in the academic world or in the political world because of all this political correctness. And boy, it's sure, the pendulum is sure swinging a different way now when you hear some of the rhetoric that's being used about people of color, people of different religions. It's ugly, and it's scary. And I think finally I'm kind of pleased to see that no one or fewer people are looking on this situation as being kind of funny, as being sort of a joke. And I think some people are finally waking up to how serious and potentially deadly this rhetoric can be.
Deadly. I would certainly highlight that. And I just don't think it's coincidental. I think a lot of people are employing similar rhetoric that even that you use in the novel that white people had at this particular time and talking about this period after the Civil War and during Reconstruction. I think it's being done deliberately to kind of motivate, encourage white animosity to get out and vote and whatever they think needs to be done to, you know, handle this situation and maintain white domination in the way that they think it should be organized. We'll see if we can nab a few callers here. If we don't have time for speechifying, so if you could just get your question in,
okay,
Mr. Howell, okay, and we'll get as many of the callers as we can. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Mr. Howell? You should be with us. Your line should be open, sir.
Can you hear me, sir?
You are very low. Your volume is very, very low.
Hopefully this is better. Evening.
Good evening, sir. That is better.
Yes, sir. Good evening, sir. Good evening to the guest. I'm very interesting. I had a few questions for you. First question, you did a lot of talking about the complexion issue as far as light skin, dark skin, as far as it goes with blacks. Can you, as a white man, tell me if you or other whites, you skin tone of a black person to prejudge or practice racism on them, against them? Or is the skin tone really not an issue? It doesn't matter their skin tone as long as they're black.
I do think there is a difference in how people, white people, perceive black people based on skin tone, unfortunately. I think that has been, I think it just seems to stay with us. And I'm not sure what the answer is there.
Okay, Gus kind of took my question. I was going to ask you about Mr. Trump. But with the rhetoric he's using that is very, very flagrantly racist against not just, you know, Mexicans, Arabs, and not denouncing the KKK now, how far do you think it would take to push white people to going back to us having a Tulsa-like event or a Rosewood event, or like the event you mentioned in Chicago earlier?
I do think the general population is not like it was, say, San Trigo. But I subscribe to the Southern Poverty Law Center newsletter, and you've probably seen those reports too. I think since President Obama was elected, I think the number of white supremacy, white hate groups in the United States has over his 7 years in office, I think it has done something like quadruple in number. Certainly among a certain constituency, the numbers are growing. And I think it's up to all of us. I'm sorry?
Can I rephrase the question just a little? Do you think that whites are capable of today of going back to having a Tulsa-like event or, a Rosewood-like event, Wilmington? Do you think that they're capable of doing that today, with the given climate?
I do not feel that would be something that could happen now, but I think all of us have to work to make sure that nothing like that ever were to happen. I mean, here, just a few miles from me, 40 miles from me at Chapel Hill, three highly educated, good citizen Muslim students at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, were murdered by a guy who said he had an argument with them about a parking space, and they were practicing Muslims. They were proud of their faith, and it's hard to believe that those actions occurred just because of a parking space.
Well, you know what? I'm going to wrap up my questions for you. Thank you very much for taking my call, and Gus, thanks.
For sure.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Pause for Katrina. I would submit what happened in New Orleans 2005. That right there is modern Tulsa example that the exact sort of thing could happen, did happen 2005. We talked about that before. A.C. Thompson's report gives it to you in detail. White vigilante terrorism on the loose in the 21st century. Mr. Demry Ford, did you have a question for Mr. Ross Howell Jr., author of Forsaken? Your line should be open.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, Mr. Howell.
Yes, hello.
Can you hear me, Gus? Okay.
Hi.
All right. My question would be, well, Gus covered it pretty good, but I assume that you believe that Virginia Christian committed the crime.
I do believe that she did. Yes, she said that she did murder the widow. She said that she, that she had assaulted the widow. She said that she had made her angry, but she did say that when she left the scene, that the widow was still breathing.
Okay. My question is that, you know, if there was a juvenile justice system at that time, I'm sure that they were not sentencing or treating juveniles as adults at that time. But given the time and the environment, you know, Miss Christian probably never had a chance, whether or not she had capable lawyers or not. But the book did mention about the Allen Gang, a group of white terrorists that committed violent acts and killed a judge. You know, this guy got the death penalty also. But I thought it was, you know, I read somewhere concerning a book called Old Sparky, and I think that it was only used once before Miss Christian was executed. In the book, it said that they put the prongs on her arms rather than on her head and her feet, that it was the way it was normally done, and that would create more pain and suffering, because she would feel more of the electrical shock rather than it numbing parts of her brain and then quickly expiring. Doing your research, did you find anything similar to that concerning the electric chair?
I sure did. There were conflicting newspaper accounts about the actual effect of the chair on her. Some accounts seem to depict it as a fairly calm passing. There was one thing that did come up was evidently she did inhale right before they threw the power, which resulted in the air in her lungs heating and rushing out of her throat, which made it sounded like she was screaming. And that is pretty clearly what happened. But there are other accounts that describe her death as just horrible and grisly, that there was smoke coming from her body, that there were great convulsions, and so on and so forth. So I think I go to what Mr. Darren Moten used as his title for his doctoral thesis was a gruesome warning for black girls. I think, you know, this was an execution that was meant to send a message. But I did want to go back to a point you made earlier, two points. You were exactly right. In the 1902 Constitution of Virginia, Virginia Christian, by her age, was supposed to be treated as a juvenile. She was not, under Virginia code, she was not to be executed. She was not even supposed to be incarcerated. She was, by law, supposed to be treated as a juvenile, where she would be kept in a facility where she would learn a trade, learn some way to make a living, and then at that point some determination would be made about her ultimate fate or her ultimate release back into society. The problem was that for black girls in Virginia, no such institution existed. So, and you're also exactly right on the point that you made, which is As a matter of fact, the quality of her legal representation, or even the fact that the state was acting contrary to its own law, it's all a moot point, because the fact that as a black girl she had murdered a white person, that trumped everything, as Darren Moten says. It trumped her age. It trumped her sex. Race trumped everything. And her fate really was sealed from the moment that the widow died. But thank you for your question, sir.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Morning, Owen. Retired firefighter in Florida. Did you have a question for Mr. Howell? You should be with us.
Yes, sir. I don't have the book or anything, but from listening to some of the excerpts from the book, it sounds like, how grotesque some of it sounds. Do you have any personal experiences of racism and white supremacy around you that you can share with us that may give us an idea of what you have in the book? A lot of times people write books, they have some personal experiences that are similar to what they're writing about. And this is where I'm coming from with that. And just would like to, ask you, do you have anything that to share with us that would give us some indication on how you had help into writing some of the more grotesque points about the different things that were taking place in the book?
Yes, sir. Thank you. I for some of the more grotesque things, sad to say, there are photographs, and you may have seen them, of a number of the lynchings that were taking place across the South and into the Midwest and West, for that matter. These were horrific. One of the things I think that's most horrifying about them is when you see the apparent humor and nonchalance among that are on the faces of the individuals in the white crowd. I happily have never seen anything like that in my lifetime, never experienced anything in my lifetime like that. But I do remember when I was growing up, and I was, a television witness to Dr. King's marches in Birmingham, in Memphis, when I did see the treatment of black citizens by white officials in the police forces, by politicians. I remember reading about and seeing pictures of Medgar Evers when he was shot down in his own driveway in front of his wife and daughters. I remember seeing the pictures of Dr. King when he was standing on the balcony at the motel where he was shot down. And those things have stayed with me. I grew up in Virginia at the time. I attended a segregated elementary school. I remember listening to the news on the TV when the public schools in Prince Edward County, Virginia, were shut down by local officials rather than obey the federal court order that they integrate. So I have seen, certainly in the media, instances of this type of savage
and horrific violence. You said you went to a segregated school. What do you mean when you say you went to a segregated school?
My elementary school was segregated by law in Virginia. And the response of the Virginia General Assembly to the order to desegregate the schools, there was a political action that came to be called massive resistance, where in the case of Prince Edward County, they actually closed all the schools. But what happened in other school systems in the state when I was in elementary schools is these white academies would be set up and white children would be taken to them. And the public schools in many cases were then relegated to black students. And this went on until basically when I entered high school in 1968, and my high school down in southwestern Virginia was integrated at that point.
Okay, through all of that discourse, I'm getting that when you said segregated school, you meant that it was all white.
That's right, yes, sir. My school was all white.
Okay, last question. What was I going to ask? With the writing of this book, did you have any social political reasoning for it, or just because you have the talent to write things? What's your reasoning for writing a book of this type?
I thought this story, the story of Virginia Christian, for some reason, it was kind of a hidden page of history, and I felt that people should know about
it. Hidden to who?
Pardon me?
Hidden to who?
Did I want to know about
it? White people or non-white people?
I wanted white people to know about it.
Oh? So you stating that white people don't know about racism?
No, I'm not saying they don't know about racism. I was hoping that if they learned about how this young girl was treated as a human being, that it would help them to understand better the treatment that African Americans have had to endure in this country for so many generations.
And this will get white people to stop practicing racism?
I hoped it would help them improve as human beings, certainly to be aware. I think, unfortunately, too many people have forgotten some of the things that have been done in the past and don't understand the frustration and distrust that many black people feel because of it.
Well, is there anything historically that would indicate to you that what you have just said is a reality, that through somehow or white people being informed through a book or a movie or something like that, is there any indication based on what you see today and what's in store for the future that white people are actually responding favorably to the statements that you are making?
The problems obviously continue to go on. I mean, at least no governors anywhere are standing in the doorway of a public institution saying that they will focus the legal power of their state against a young African-American girl attending that school, we don't see that anymore. I'm not sure exactly how
you're right, sir. They may not be standing in front of the door, but that doesn't mean that there's some sort of improvement, because I see right here in the state of Florida where they what takes place instead of standing in the door. You know, I mean, I want to walk way down there to that schoolhouse to stand in front of the door. Well, the only thing I can do is pass legislation that would harm in the people activity of education non-white black people even more. And even that was symbolic.
Oh, I understand.
That was only symbolic.
Yeah.
You know, it's similar to what Mr. Trump is doing. Primarily, everything he's doing is symbolic. But anyway, I don't want to take up all of the time. And I've been quite satisfied on where I think you're coming from. It's kind of like, unfortunately, business as usual. But anyway... Thank you, guys.
All right, sir. Well, thank you for your question.
Mm-hmm. Caller in Michigan, did you have a question for Mr. Howell? You should be with us.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, and to the callers, listeners, and to your guests. My question is, I think you kind of answered it, but I just wasn't clear. Who is your intended audience?
I hope that both white people and black people would read the book, ma'am.
Okay. It kind of sounded like this Charlie, is it Mir? Was that the character's name? Person's name? Okay, uh-huh. It kind of sounded like he was like your hero or something. Is that accurate?
I don't know that I would call him a hero, but he was someone who had a strong religious belief. He was a very principled person, and he tried to live his life in a way that could make those principles realities. He tried to live that way.
Okay. Did you agree with Gus's definition of racism, white supremacy at the beginning of the program?
Yes, I did.
Okay. I'm just wondering, in a system of racism, white supremacy, is it possible for a white person to not be a racist, consciously or unconsciously practicing it?
I certainly think it's possible. I think it's possible for, and I'm hoping that every person will treat every other person as a human being with their own rights, their own dignity, their own humanity, whether they look similar to us or different from us, white or black.
I have just two more questions. Who do you feel is most confused about racism, white people or non-white people?
Oh, I would have to say white people.
You said white people are most confused?
Yes.
Okay. And then I heard you say that back then, during this time, when you were when this incident occurred with the Virginia, you said race trumps everything or trumped everything. So, you know, a lot of the laws didn't apply to her. Would you say that is applicable today, that race trumped everything today?
Well, I think you certainly have to look at I think if you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, if you look at the number of young African-American men in jail as opposed to other segments of the population, I mean, you have to look at that and wonder, well, something something must be at work here. I mean, sad to say, yeah, I think there's still enormous questions about racial justice and freedom in this country.
So are you saying race trumps everything today?
Am I saying it trumps everything? No, ma'am. I think in the case of Virginia Christian, the fact that as a black person in Jim Crow, that she had taken a white person's life, everything in the whole system was just loaded against her. I don't think she really stood a chance. Is it a lot better in our system now? I don't know that it's a lot better. Certainly when you see how many African Americans ultimately are exonerated, often by DNA evidence, after they've been convicted of crimes and spent decades in prison, I think you have to look at that system and wonder how much it's been improved.
Okay, that's all my questions. Thanks for answering them, and thanks for taking my call.
Yes, ma'am, I appreciate it.
I'm not going to take up your whole evening. Just had last couple callers, and then we will let you enjoy the rest of your Monday evening, Mr. Howell. Caller in Virginia, did you have a question for Mr. Ross Howell Jr.? You should be with us.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, greetings to everyone on the line. Mr. Howell, why did you title the book Forsaken?
I use that title because I felt that that was what happened to Virginia Christian, and I felt that society turned its back on her, and that it failed to acknowledge her humanity. And I felt that the title seemed to make sense given the fact that the narrator was a Christian and thought that the words of Christ at the end of Christ's human life was his question about why had he been forsaken. And Charlie's response to that was that revealed that he was truly human. And so that was the idea behind the title.
Okay. Earlier, you said that the dog, Lucky, was a metaphor for how people were treated. Who exactly mm-hmm. are the people that you were saying the dog was a metaphor for?
I saw the dog as you know, when Charlie finds him, he has barbed wire for a collar, and he's dragging a chain. And I felt that was a metaphor for the brutality that many African Americans endured as slaves. And as I said earlier, Charlie does manage to rescue this starving animal. He nurses him to health. He protects him, feeds him, and still a new system of violence has emerged in Charlie's period. That ultimately he fails at protecting the dog from that violence.
Okay. In chapter 7 of your book, after the narrator states that he doesn't know much about intimacy, that was the word you used, you detail how he and his black male childhood friend, Red, would grope and watch a black female child dance and reveal her genitals to them for, like, a penny mm-hmm. or at times for nothing at all. why did you include this in the book, especially given that it seemingly has little to do with the case against Virginia Christian at all?
I thought that also was a part of Jim Crow, that as Gus had mentioned earlier, that in the depiction of women, I do sometimes have the black females as very strong figures, and maybe even masculine figures, as Gus pointed out. But sad to say, the black women so often were also seen as sexual objects, a way of exerting power. You know, you see it so often you could say, I mentioned Thomas Jefferson several times in the book, and obviously his conduct with his slaves and with Sally Hemings in particular are just a victimization in its greatest extent.
And then talking about sex being used as a tool for victimizing non-white people, have you yourself ever had sex with a non-white person?
Candidly, ma'am, no, I have not.
Okay. Thank you for answering that question.
Sure.
Lastly, earlier you stated that race relations was used as describing the subjugation of non-white by white. What would you say, if any, the difference is in the meaning of race relations when that term is used today?
I'm sorry, ma'am, you broke up a little bit. Could I ask you just to repeat the last question?
Sure. You stated earlier that race relations, that term, was used as describing the subjugation of non-white by white. What would you say, if any, the difference is in the meaning of race relations when that term is used today?
Yeah, it's a complicated question. It's almost like we need to find a better way to describe our interactions. I feel like when I've gone to several readings where I've talked about the book and read from the book, that the conversations, I always feel they occur at a human level. I mean, sometimes we do talk about racial issues, but more often it seems to be to look at the character, the historical character, Virginia Christian, to look at the historical figure, George Fields, and to see what happened to them as human beings. I know you sometimes hear people say we're in a post-racial society. I don't feel that to be the case. I think, sadly, that racial problems are still with us. I struggle to find the right language, the right words to articulate the difference now.
Okay, so just to make sure I have a clear understanding of your answer, are you saying there is no difference when that term is used, that they're still talking about subjugation of non-white by white?
I do think, and still in our terminology, that there is that underlying meaning. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's all my questions. Thank you.
For sure. The caller at 2456, 2456, did you have a question for Mr. Howell?
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking
your,
my call.
Your volume is very low. If you could speak up, give us your full volume, please, ma'am.
Sorry about that. Is that better?
That is an improvement.
Okay. My question is, do you know of any other young women in Virginia since Miss Christian that killed a white woman in self-defense and that, you know, was declared not guilty?
I do not. I certainly do not.
Okay. Okay. And one more question. Why do you think white people don't want to do their own work as far as, you know, from coming from slavery, not wanting to pick your own cotton, and then bringing it up to... In her time, now this woman had two daughters, but they still wanted to have Miss Virginia come and do all the work. Why do you think white people don't want to do their own work?
I think at that time, and I think even today, it's seen as a social status. You know, to have, again, it was a way of elevating one race, saying, you know, well, we don't really need to do the kind of daily work that's necessary, so we have others who,
breastfeeding?
Who do it for us.
Breastfeeding also?
I'm sorry, ma'am, I didn't hear you.
Like when the black women used to breastfeed the white children, was that part of a social status, you think? I mean, that's work, too. I mean, that's child, you know, child rearing, but it's still work. A lot of times they didn't even want to do that. So
I understand. You know, that is something I am just not familiar with. I have to admit I have not. Come across that, but I'm sure that you're exactly right that did occur, but it's just not something I have any knowledge to comment meaningfully on it.
Okay. Well, thanks for taking those questions. I'll mute my line.
For sure. Last caller from Mr. Howell. Ross, did you have a question for Mr. Howell? You should be with us.
Yes, greetings to you, Gus, and greetings to you, Mr. Howell. I did have two questions for you. The first one would be, why would you, as a white man, use a non-human character like you use the dog to represent the human suffering of black people, especially with the history of black people being described as basically subhuman throughout our experience with white people, no matter where we've been on the planet, but especially in the United States?
Well, there's even a character in the novel who notes the fact that in his mind, the girl's life doesn't matter any more than the dog's. Again, I use that metaphor because I felt the great danger we always run in any society is, you know, is treating one person as something other than a human being. That was the great danger that from the very beginning of slavery here and in other countries, the justification for it was that these human beings are something other than human, and therefore we have the right to own them and abuse them.
Okay, thank you. And my other question kind of piggybacks off of that. Just based on the collective historical and even contemporary experience of black people and non-white people as far as their mistreatment by white people. Would you say that racism, white supremacy is white culture? Would you agree with that statement? And that would be my final question. Thank you for taking my call.
All right, sir. And could you just repeat that again? I lost a little bit of it.
Sure. I was just saying, due to the collective, both historical and contemporary experience of black people and non-white people, as far as our mistreatment by white people, would you agree with the statement that racism, white supremacy, is white culture?
I would have to say, unfortunately, I do feel that, particularly in this political climate, that many whites do seem to hold that position.
Thank you so much for taking my questions.
Hmm. All right, sir.
Right on. Just before I let you go, I just wanted to ask you, towards the end of the novel, after Virginia Christian has been executed, and think of the governor's mansion, and even when the coroner, Dr. V, I'm forgetting the exact pronunciation, but the coroner, Dr. V, when he's talking to Charlie Mears, it seems that a lot of white people present fears that the white race will be exterminated, this fear of miscegenation. They give like anecdotes with this white girl who gets pregnant by a black soldier, mm-hmm. and, you know, ruins her whole life. She gets syphilis and, you know, has this child and everything, ruins her whole life. And this just gets presented over and over and over. And it reminded me so much, author, psychiatrist, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. She's a black author. And her theory with regards to why white people practice white supremacy is white people have a fear of white genetic annihilation, that if they have sexual intercourse with non-white people and there's too much of this, the offspring will be dark, highly melanated, and that you will no longer have people that have the phenotypical characteristics that we associate with white people. They'll look like President Obama or something like that. And there's so many examples of that in the book. I just wanted to get your thoughts. Do you think that's why white people practice white supremacy, why they terrorize black people? Do you think that's what's motivating this mistreatment?
Well, I think certainly in the period of this novel, I mean, you know, what you just described there, Gus, is what that character, Dr. Plecker, uses. He says he describes it as, you know, the interbreeding is what he calls the suicide of the white race. And that was the huge fear at that time, that the white race would be bred out of existence. That was the great fear for all of these, or certainly of all the ones that I read, of these racial supremacy, white supremacy groups of the time. And you know you've seen it. I mean, if you get the if you get the notices from the Southern Poverty Law Center, I mean, that language, that rhetoric is still out there. It is still out there today. So, yes, that fear of the colored race is subsuming the white races, that was certainly the great fear during this period, 1912 and forward, that led to those what they call the racial integrity laws. And sad to say, you still see that language today.
Absolutely. Appreciate you hanging out with us and getting all of our questions in. The author of the book, Forsaken, Mr. Ross Howell Jr., detailing what happened with Miss Virginia Christian in 1912, Virginia. Really enjoyed having the discussion. Glad you could hang out with us this evening. And if you do some more writing on racism, we will look forward to having you back on the program.
Okay, Gus. Well, thank you very much.
For sure. Take care.
All right.
Evening. Context of white supremacy. Fascinating. We'll do a quick commercial, and then if folks have any commentary they want to make sure that they get in, we'll make time for that as well. Actually, this is not even really a commercial. This is from the movie The Green Mile. A lot of similarity, unfortunately, with that film and what we talked about this evening, but they have a profound segment of the film where they are talking about black people and canines. We even had the sound effect to amplify, but profound segment. And then folks have any commentary, we'll make time for that as well. But this is from Tom Hanks, The Green Mile.
We had a dog, just a sweet mongrel, you know the kind. Well, in many ways, a good mongrel dog is like a Negro. You get to know it. Often, you get to love it. It is of no particular use, but you keep it around because you think it loves you. If you're lucky, Mr. Edgecombe, you never have to find out any different. My wife and I were not so lucky. Caleb, come here for a second. Come here. Please, sir. He still has the one good eye. I suppose he's lucky not to be completely blind. We get down on our knees and thank God for that much at least. Right, Caleb? Okay, go on in now. That dog attacked my boy for no reason. Just got it in his mind one day. Same with John Coffey. He was sorry afterwards. Of that, I have no doubt. But those little girls stayed raped and murdered. Maybe he'd never done it before. My dog never bit before. But I didn't concern myself with that. I went out there with my rifle and grabbed his collar and blew his brains out. Is Coffey guilty? Yes, he is. Don't you doubt it. And don't you turn your back on him. You may get away with it once, or even 100 times. But in the end, you'll get bit.
Context of white supremacy. John Coffey, like the drink, Green Mile. Excellent metaphor to wrap things. I encourage all the time, pay attention to the metaphors. Pay attention to the metaphors. There is a reason on the Saturday program why I say no metaphors. Let's just be clear and direct about what we're saying. It is fascinating what happens frequently when people start using metaphors to describe racism, white supremacy. Fascinating. You should definitely perk up, be very alert anytime that starts to happen. In that vein, before I even get to any of my comments or anything folks want to get in, one more metaphor from the book. The main character, Charlie Mears, white reporter, real person, he did indeed work for a black newspaper in Virginia. I asked Dr. Moten this earlier today, and he said that that is true. And there is a passage in Mr. Howell's book where he talks about this, where the black editor didn't even want to hire him and was like, you know, what do I look like having a black newspaper and hiring a white guy? And, you know, there are black journalists who need this job and blah, blah, blah. And but he hires him anyway. And Mr. Mears describes his experience when he starts out working at this black newspaper. And this is the way Mr. Howell writes it in the novel. He says, work was worse than I expected. Pressmen and reporters, the black pressmen and reporters, acknowledged me only if I greeted them first. They would mumble some response, eyes downcast or darting away from my face. If someone looked me in the eye, it was to express seething anger. It was like looking into the colored versions of the eyes of the white mob who had wanted to lynch Virginia Christian. I kept to myself. I will stop there. Fascinating. I mean, specifically, this is a simile, but to have an analogy where black people who are angry or not pleased with a white man being hired to write for a black newspaper, to compare them to a white terrorist mob that wants to lynch a black child. Wow. Metaphors. Really got to pay attention to those metaphors. It is amazing the types of comparisons people will make when they start talking about white supremacy. That's it. Quick things that I wanted to get out, and then callers, if they have any commentary they would like to share, they can do so as well. Dr. Moden, it was so great. I'm so glad I read the entire book, because at the end of the book, Mr. Howe has the acknowledgments, and the very first acknowledgment that he gives is to Dr. Darren Moden, black male. He's a professor down in Alabama. He took an hour out of his morning to talk to me and talk about this book. And he said that he and Mr. Howe, they're supposed to do a radio program together in March. I was so glad to hear he said that, number one, people had told him, because he wrote his dissertation on Virginia Christian. And he said people had approached him and said, you know, you should write a novel about this. And he said, you know, ugh, I have no interest. I have no interest in doing that at all. What happened, the facts of this case are so much more fascinating and profound than, you know, trying to make up some fiction to tell a story about all this. But he talked to me and shared his thoughts, and he said one thing that he thinks is critically important is that they cannot locate where Virginia Christian was buried. And he said that that is a task that he's undertaking and trying to find her plot. And if she does not have a headstone, to get a headstone. And I mean, that is common. If you remember when we talked about Virginia earlier this year with Kristen Green, black burial ground, where they put a dog walking park in a parking lot, I think, in Virginia over a black cemetery. And I mean, this is common, widespread disrespect of black people in life and in death. But that was one thing that he wanted to share. And he said, soliciting support, if anybody out in the area is interested, particularly if you're in the Virginia area and you have time to kind of explore, investigate to see if people can help locate where Virginia Christian was buried. He thinks that is super important, and to try to get a headstone if there is not one already present. He also thought it was important, the Commonwealth, the Old Dominion, state of Virginia, has never acknowledged, not that I'm surprised, but he just, the significance that they have never acknowledged, like, we violated our own state laws in killing this black child. There has never been a, you know, mea culpa, my fault, we shouldn't have done that, even though it's been 100 years or more than 100 years now, that has never happened. And he thinks that that there should be an effort to make that happen at some point, to at least get an acknowledgement of this was totally wrong. This should not have been done. And we violated our own law in killing this black child, that should be acknowledged by the state of Virginia. To this point, that has not happened. And he said the same thing. He is not surprised. And I seriously doubt that, you know, I mean, it would have to be a monumental turn of events if they are upset about not having Take Me Back, Carry Me Back to Old Virginia as the state song. I cannot imagine a world where white supremacy still reigns and white people come out to say, my bad, we didn't mean to kill that nigger child 100 years ago. Other things. This reminded me so much of more recent events in the history of Virginia. Michael Vick and the dog scandal. Allen Iverson, I have suggested people check out that documentary, No Crossover, the trial of Allen Iverson, where he was a juvenile at the time, and white people were looking to hem him up and totally decimate his life and career and have him in jail for this brawl that happened in Virginia when he was still in high school. He has the profound moment in the film where he's talking before they make a judgment in his case about what's going to happen to him, where he says, you know, this white judge has a lot of power over our lives. That was the case with Virginia Christian. That was the case with Allen Iverson. That was the case with Michael Vick. That is the case worldwide, as long as this system still exists. Moving forward, I think this case is important. I think Dr. Moten really emphasized as well, in terms of us thinking of the ongoing required criminalization of black children, that this is just another example. If you want to talk about Tamir Rice, if you want to talk about Michael Brown Jr., if you want to talk about Renisha McBride, male, female, it does not matter, that this is a long history, a requirement, a necessity in the system of white supremacy, where white children just are not viewed, thought of as children. They are mongrels. beasts, savages, brutes, and, you know, we need to hurry up and get them in jail as soon as possible. But long-running tradition, this is not new, and he really encouraged people to kind of keep that in mind, the way that this we see this continue to play out in the 21st century, the way that we criminalize and think of black children, that it happens all the time. I'm even reminded of one of our infamous guests, Freddie Lee, although he is not a white person, so-called Asian male, but he voiced his displeasure with black children, 5-year-old black children that he was upset with and felt the need to retaliate against them because of something that they said. 5-year-old black children, 11-year-old black children. He didn't retaliate to the white people that had harmed and mistreated him on the job, but black children, oh yeah, not going to tolerate anything from any of these old nigger children. The white people that write these sort of stories, again, we just had Kristen Green on the program. She talked about Prince Edward County when they closed their schools for 5 years. Black children couldn't get education for 5 years. And they, as he said, opened up these private academies and what have you for white children. This happened. They didn't close the public schools everywhere, but they did open these private academies and what have you. That was widespread, not just in Virginia, but throughout the country, particularly in the South. But when white people write these accounts, I cannot emphasize enough, in my view, that is a massive way that white supremacy operates, where they become the authorities, the voice, the quote unquote experts on what has happened to black people. When I was talking to Dr. Moten, I was bringing these exact points up. People will not, I don't think, people will say, hey, Dr. Moten is the go-to person that we need to talk to about Virginia Christian. He wrote a thesis on this and has continued to research, has spent, you know, about 2 decades researching what happened with this case and important figures and what have you. It'll end up being this white guy who wrote a fictional account. And I mean, to just the enormity of it, like even as the program was moving along, and I understood, I don't like fiction. I don't read fiction. Pretty much all of the texts that I read, they're nonfiction, biographies, autobiographies, real accounts of things that happened. And even within that, if it's a white author, you still have to kind of dig through, because sometimes they're not being accurate and truthful in presenting information. But I mean, fiction, like, oh, it's anything. Or you could just make up anything as we go along. To have a white person write a book where the main white character, and Dr. Moten emphasized this, he said there is no evidence that Charlie Mears, this white reporter, that he, you know, was so sympathetic to Virginia Christian. He said the evidence just doesn't support that. Like, yes, he wrote some articles. Yes, he wrote to Governor Mann at the time, white man and Confederate soldier. But there's no evidence that, you know, he was just all shook up about Virginia Christian and, you know, really impacted. The evidence just doesn't support that. To have a white man writing a book where this is supposed to be focused on this black child who was executed by the state of Virginia, and the main character, the main focus of the book ends up being on this white guy, white male reporter, where we fictionalize, we make up, lie, and say that he had his genitals mutilated when that's not true, that he had a cross burned in his yard when that's not true, and all of these other, this dialogue that he allegedly has in the prison with Virginia Christian, and they're talking bad about Mary Church Terrell, who is with the National Association of Colored Women, when that's not true. They didn't have that sort of dialogue. I mean, that is, in my view, massive acts of racism. I think white people, they understand the value of emphasizing, even if they have to lie, of these well-meaning white people and inserting them, that you have all these good white people, these well-meaning white people, and oh, let's focus on him. He did so much to help this little negress, and you know, it's a shame that she got killed, but you know, he did what he could do, and he certainly wasn't racist. They do a lot of that, whether it's, you know, really overplaying John Brown or Harriet Beecher Stowe. It is monumental, and just to have this guy being presented in this way where he is a victim. There's lots and lots of white victimization in this book that's supposed to be focused on a black female that was executed. But having this white guy presented as, you know, the victim, they even have white females that are being molested by their white uncle. Like, they've got all this other backstory. They got a white male who is quote unquote homosexual and he commits suicide. Like, all this other stuff that's totally irrelevant to Virginia Christian, and seeming like a lot of this stuff is just totally fabricated. Like, what purpose does that serve? I have no idea how that helps advance the story. In my view, that is only just additional layers of white supremacy, where we're empathizing, identifying with this white guy, these white people, and Virginia Christian has just faded into the background. Oh, she's been executed. Oh, well. The dogs, you all asked about the metaphor. I'm glad when he was first explaining it, before it came up where our female caller in Virginia and Ross, you all asked, redirected and asked him more questions about that. I thought that was huge. Just him pointing out, you know, the even though he didn't say explicitly that this dog Lucky, who was chained with barbed wire, and the well-meaning white man comes out and rescues him, and then ultimately the dog is poisoned by racists who burn a cross in the yard and poison the dog. It reminded me of Nat King Cole, where white people killed his dog as well. Even though that happened, that is based in fact, in truth, and this is just some total fabrication. But I thought the dog was treated better than Virginia Christian in the book. I didn't even think there was a direct. I see what he's saying, but I thought the dog was treated much better than Virginia Christian. Again, I'm reminded of Michael Vick. When the dog dies, Charlie Mears goes over and hugs the dog. And oh, man, Lucky is gone. Oh, and there are other people that are whimpering and so sad, like, oh, I can't believe this happened. And they remember the dog later on. And oh, this is such a tragic loss. And why did they have to do this? And I see that all the time, where animals, dogs, squirrels, bats, cats, mosquitoes, anything is treated better than a black person. Metaphor, super important, and I think we talked about that a lot. Last thing I'll get into, take me back to Old Virginia, because that does come out in the text. It reminds me so much of Dixie. If I had heard that song, I'm surprised I hadn't made time to listen to that song before. As a Virginia native, I never heard that song while I was in Virginia. I didn't even know that that was the state song at some point. I didn't even learn about that until I had, you know, left the state and hadn't been gone for quite some time. But if I had heard that song earlier, I would have been playing that song much more often on the program. It reminds me so much of Dixie. There are even reports that a black person wrote the song Dixie. The Dixie is supposed to be from the perspective, too, of a black person who is sad and lamenting the South the way it was when white people had their system of slavery intact, where they just could go and systemically rape black people whenever they felt like it, and the way that it operated at that time, the system of racism. Dixie is set up in the same way as Take Carry Me Back to Old Virginia. I would be playing that song on the regular. It sounds like a hymn of racism, white supremacy. If I was in Virginia, I would be playing this song all the time, and specifically for that purpose of emphasizing this is how white people feel. You all didn't want the song removed. I don't want it removed either. Let's be honest about how you feel, what you think. Let's have white supremacy culture out front explicitly 24/7, because that's what we're in. Let's not lie and try to pretend that that's not what we have, that this is old, this is a relic of the past. That's not true. That's what it is. 2016. Let's play this every day. We can have that as the anthem when school starts, no matter where you are, anywhere in the state of Virginia. Take Carry Me Back to Old Virginia. Anything that's serious matters, let's play the song. I would put it out front every single time just to make it clear. And I suspect if black people started doing that, white people would get uncomfortable with the song. I suspect you would have white people starting to say, yeah, let's take that down. The niggers are using this to make sure that they're not confused about what it means to be a white person and what we are dedicated to terrorizing black people 24/7 worldwide. I don't know if people that are in Virginia, if you all have heard that song before, but wow. Incredible. And again, Doug Wilder, those notes, if people want to do any research, those notes, I believe they're at Virginia Union, where he said he saved them when white people wrote in, racists wrote in to chastise, admonish, threaten him, make racist remarks when he removed this song as the official state song of Virginia. And again, this is not ancient history. This is like within the last 20 years or so. That all of this went down. And I think he also did some other things to remove some of the white supremacy symbolism in the state and what have you. And it was the same sort of response that you're seeing now in Charleston and other places where they're trying to do the same. With that, The folks that dialed in, if you all have any commentary on what you heard from Mr. Howell, the book, what have you, anything stood out, feel free to get your questions in. So the caller that wanted me to ask him about political correctness, my bad, just it slipped my mind before he exited. I would have asked him to explain what he what his definition, what he means when he used the term political correctness. My fault. We'll see if we can get that from a white guest in the future. Folks have any comments?
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening. Good evening once again, Thomas Smith in New York. Yeah, Gus, you know, when you were reading some of the passages from the book and what happened to the white guy in the book, you know, it started to sound like The Purge and so many other white stories where the white person is the hero, but they also get punished for being the hero. You know, so white people look good in the eyes of black people. But it also reinforces to the white people reading that there's consequences and repercussions for helping them black people. And I think it served both purposes. You know, the lady asked a question to him about, you know, pretty much why were white people, you know, so not willing to do the work. And, you know, I don't think that it's white people don't do the work. I think that white people worked very hard to create a situation where they don't have to do the work, and they work very hard at maintaining and keeping that structure in place, which is probably more harder work than we think, and give them credit for. You know, it's never ending work. It has to be done in all areas of people activity. You know, they can't get any sleep doing the work. They can't be lazy. Gus, when you did the Rocky show, you know, and the white people were getting lazy, a white person jumped on, you know, all of a sudden they start working out all the time, you know, they're going to the gym, you know, they don't want to do the work. They've set up a situation where they don't have to do the work, and that took hard work to do. Also, you know, I think that black people study us so well. And I know that during the plantation time where they were doing all the experimentations and stuff they were doing, they realized that the black woman's breast milk had way more nourishment, vitamins, and minerals than their own breast milk. And that practice still persists today on the black market. I was just saw a report where in Detroit where they're, you know, bankrupt and a lot of people are doing bad. Black mothers are selling their breast milk on the black market for almost $40 an ounce to white women, and they're feeding their baby, the synthetic milk that you buy from the store. And, you know, also, you know, I think that formal practice of the suckling on that nipple, even though white women, I think that they knew that their babies were developing much better with that milk. But the white babies may have started to develop a little, a bond to that black person, and they stopped that. And I think that's why Gerber and a lot of the new organic baby foods have that logo of that white baby on them, especially so black babies, you know, when they're eating and they see that Gerber baby on that thing that, you know, their mother just put this, you know, the spoon in, you know, they already have the psychologically a good feeling about looking at white people. I think that's done intentional. You know, the question I asked him about the light skin and dark skin, you know, I'm not sure. I'm not white. I personally don't think that white people care if you're white, light skin or dark skin in this country. I mean, like Brazil, it was such a big deal that they created another class of people called mulattoes. You know, you could be an Afro-Brazilian, a Brazilian, or a mulatto Brazilian. But here, you know, you're black or white. They were very persistent about that. And lastly, what I wanted to say, I don't know if you saw it today, Gus. It was a bunch of black people marching at a Donald Trump event, and he was kicking them out pretty much. Did you see that? At the same time, a reporter got punched in the face by a Secret Service guy.
I haven't seen that.
Oh, okay. Well, it was a group of black people protesting his event. I mean, I say at least 50. Marching around and being booed by the crowd, and he's, you know, get him out of here. And then he goes to his, you know, he points out one person in the crowd, is that a Mexican? And everyone stands up and just starts booing this girl and, you know, get her down. She don't, you know, belong here. And, I mean, it sounds to me a lot like you're about to see the reconstruction. You know, that's what it's looking like. And I just wanted to know if you saw that, because when I saw that today, I was like, wow, especially a day after he refused to denounce the endorsement from the KKK, that happened. It's like, man, he's serious. I mean, this is really serious. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
For sure. Harry Reid, incidentally, did say that white people did pay attention to President Obama being a little less melanated, and he thinks that that did factor into him being able to sit in the White House for the past 7 years and change. I know Jane Elliott admitted racist when she came on the program. She concurred and said that she thinks that's the case as well. Not that you're not a nigger, just as we go about doing our business, we can use some of the less melanated niggers to do our business and get things done and what have you. But that both of them did say that they seem to think white people do pay attention to that sort of thing.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. I saw the description of the Charles Mears character. He seemed to be like the proverbial black Republican, if we were still reading the Half Has Never Been Told. Essentially, it seems like any white person who is depicted as giving any sort of assistance to a black person becomes a race traitor for white people. So he basically wrote the story in the way in which he was niggified. He was basically treated like they would treat any other black person, the castration, all of that stuff. So I just feel like that was his way of kind of depicting what a race traitor would be treated like, as far as the way white people would perceive that. I also found it fairly fascinating because I asked the question about whether or not he believed that racism and white supremacy was white culture after I asked the question about him writing about the dog and using the dog as this metaphor for black people's mistreatment. And the reason why was because even with Mrs. Virginia Christian herself, and the black females, when you brought out the point that he was basically masculinating them and taking away their femininity as well as, and wrote about the history of their humanity being, our humanity being taken from us, and specifically with black females, their femininity as an addition to that. And I just found it interesting that he would use an animal, especially an animal that white people revere. The dog is an animal that they revere because they live with them in the caves, and go back to the Romans, Romulus and Remus, they were suckled by a dog. Even though that's supposed to be allegorical, I believe that it was actually accurate due to their history of living in caves with canines and being isolated in the situation they were in. And to me, that automatic style of writing in which a lot of these white authors who write these fictional accounts of whether it's a true event or something that goes harkens back to the era of slavery, it's like their default psychological mechanism as far as the dehumanization of black characters, the mongrelization of black characters, the making us anything less than human, like you said, squirrel, mosquito, you name it, we're just nothing. And to me, that's indicative of the default white culture. So for him to actually agree with that, he was exhibiting that throughout the writing of the book. I felt that his tone and approach was as such to incline and look to an idea of creating some sort of, like he said, well, he kept saying something where he wanted to humanize this one character. And in some way make people look at her for the victim that she was. But to me, anything that white people write is always written from the perspective of the dominant culture. So there's always a downplaying on some level of even the main character, just like you said earlier in the discussion. And to me, that's just default white supremacist culture. It's the way they view us. They will always view us as less than. They will always approach us from their lofty space in the system of white supremacy and the trickle-down effect to the niggers at the bottom. And he comes across, I guess, in tone. People might be fooled into thinking that he has some sort of empathy or sympathy for black people. But if you look at the psychology of his writing and just look at it in the context of Yorugu or Dr. Welsing's work or Neely Fuller Jr.'s work, or Dr. Bobby Wright's work, it all falls in the same pattern as the racist white supremacist, especially writing about black people, becoming the proverbial expert on what happened to black people, and yet still instilling and infusing, injecting the religion of racism, white supremacy throughout their writing. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
For sure. For sure. Any of the other folks who dialed in with a hand up, do y'all have questions, comments you want to get in?
Yes. I thought the guest was not very concise on his purpose of the book. And when I questioned it him, he gave the what is becoming on this program traditional line that is meant for white people, you know, as though white people are actually going to first of all, as though white people don't have an understanding of the system of race and white supremacy, what it is and how it works. And through reading his book, they're all suddenly going to have snap their finger and say, oh, now I get it, and I'll do better. It's kind of like, it ain't kind of like, it's insulting, actually, to non-white people. In my opinion, whether some of us probably won't recognize it, because, you know, a lot of cases we're so thrilled over the idea of a white person that is willing to reveal some truth about the system of racism that it kind of like throws us off focus. And just about anything that white person says from there, you know, we're not really paying attention to. But that's why I asked him from a deeper perspective. In other words, if you do something, if you go about through an experiment of doing something, then there's some sort of results that you should expect. And there's never nothing that makes any sense on the outcome in that light. And also he contradicts himself. He agreed with your meaning. He agreed with your meaning to the system of racism by supremacy. But at the same time, when he was asked about who's confused about the system of racism, he said it was white people. So the reason why I said that is a contradiction. If something is called white supremacy, how can people who are stupid in control? I mean, I'm not the smartest person in the world, so I see that as a contradiction in itself. Anytime I hear someone, white or non-white, actually answer that in the direction of, well, white people are the ones who are ignorant, it just doesn't make any logical sense. But it is something that I do think needs to be questioned, especially to white people, in every chance that we get. Because it gives you a measurement of what type of person you're communicating with, and also it reveals some truths about what really is what that particular individual white person is not revealing to you on the surface when they make comments like that. And those are just some of the things I was thinking about. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Other folks who had a hand up, do you all have comments you want to make sure you get in?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I, you know, wanted to bring up that point, talking to the guest about the way that the execution was carried out. You know, besides the fact that, you know, there was very little evidence, you know, pointing towards her guilt, and then he mentioned that she confessed, and we all know how confessions can be coerced out of people. So you can't give much credence to that confession. She didn't really confess to killing her. In fact, she was just defending herself because people in the town knew that this widow was a, they call her stern, but she was really mean, crabby, quick-tempered, and she was practicing racism on the teenage girl every chance that she got. And so when the young black girl defended herself and, you know, maybe hit her too hard, it was clearly self-defense, and she shouldn't have even, well, he did admit that she should not have been jailed in that manner, and especially not executed. And the book kind of just, you know, briefly went over the white terrorists, the Allen gang that killed that judge. And, you know, it was ironic, too, that this guy got, you know, what he deserved through the execution, but then he was only looking at 1 year in prison when his gang came in to rescue him, and it was a shootout. So she was executed, you know, for defending herself, and the white man was executed rightly so for taking the lives of several different individuals. So and you know, this whole thing is just a travesty. I'll mute my line.
For sure, for sure. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, do y'all have comments you wanted to make sure you got in?
Oh, Gus, can I say something real quick?
Let me make sure that we got everybody who hasn't had a chance to speak yet, and we'll get you. Anybody else who hasn't shared yet, did you have comments you wanted to get in? Caller from,
I have a question when Voz is done.
Yes, sir. The caller from a block line, are you just listening? You had dialed in as well with a hand up. Do you have a question you were going to get in? Comments? Nutty. Always my favorite. People dial in with their hand up and then have nothing to say. So everybody is good? Everybody who hasn't shared is good? Right on. We will wrap promptly. Roz and then Thomas in New York.
Yes, I was just going to say, I remember the author stating that essentially that she didn't really confess to killing her. She confessed to defending herself. And he said that when she left the premises, that the woman was still alive. So she didn't kill anybody, in my opinion. That says right there, when I left the premises, she might have got her behind whipped, but I didn't kill anyone. And to me, I was wondering if one of her own daughters killed her, because they said she was full of vinegar. I know the term they use is either vinegar or pissing vinegar, which means that she was probably an ornery troll type of white person. So I was wondering if maybe she was beaten to a point that she was weak enough where maybe one of her daughters could have smothered her to death. And then, of course, it would have been easy to just blame this black, young black female for the killing, because when she left the house, the woman was still alive. And if she was strangled, supposedly strangled, then that means that she should not have been alive when that woman, when that young woman left the house. And that was just something, I don't know what the history books will show, or if there's other information that was hidden or not revealed. But that says to me that that young sister did not kill that woman. And to me, a potential of someone else actually killing that person, and I would think the closest people to her might be her own children. That's just what I wanted to chime in with. Thank you.
They had a male, white male boarder in the house, and that was raised. White people even raised some suspicion if, you know, he participated or maybe he did it. And, you know, Virginia Christian, maybe she just robbed her afterwards or whatever the case. When I spoke with Dr. Moten, and again, he did his dissertation on this black male, he seemed a lot less confused. His position seemed to be that this white woman, Ida Belote, she threw a cuspidor, like a container that may have had waste in it. This is 1912 at the time, so you have a lot of people that don't have indoor plumbing, that she threw this on her. And in addition to the accusation that she had stole something, which seemed to be a regular thing, accusing Virginia Christian of having stolen something. And he said that from reviewing the evidence, it seemed that that just, you know, really upset, understandably, really upset Virginia Christian. She attacked her, defended herself after she had been assaulted physically, and she left. And this was an older white woman. He said that he thinks she was probably closer to 60 and probably not in the best health. So it could have very well been that she lingered for a minute or two and ultimately died because she was kind of in a frail state anyway. So he didn't have any evidence, or he didn't say anything that would lead to believe that he didn't think she did this, or that her children or anybody else was involved, that she just was defending herself, as anybody would, having, you know, something thrown on and this heavy object thrown on them. And then on top of it, if it's filled with waste, that, you know, you would be upset. You would defend yourself. That he thinks that's what happened. And, you know, she eventually died from the injury sustained in that. That seemed to be what Dr. Moden's conclusion was. But that was rumored. That was not just rumored. That was reported in local newspapers at the time, whether the white male border could have been involved or whatever with all of this. But Dr. Moden's conclusion seemed to be that he thinks she died, the white woman died, as a result of this altercation.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for that further clarification.
Thomas in New York, you said you had a question.
Yes, it pertains to the Saturday show, and it was you did a, you know, you mentioned the rape case in Brownsville, Brooklyn, and I just want to know where did anyone see that was a white victim? I was under the impression that the victim was a non-white person, but it was brought up several times like they were a white person. I was just a little, I didn't know if there's another report other than the one I saw, but they spoke to the father right after the incident. They didn't show his face, but you could see his hands, and he had a Latin Spanish accent.
Mm-hmm.
He did not, and he was a dark-skinned, you know, Spanish person, it looked like, from his hands. So I just wanted to know what report did you see? Because I was trying to find that myself. Like, oh, was this a white person? Especially, I can't see too many white people living in Brownsville. So I just did, especially having sex in the park. Like, that's the bull white people. You know, like, I just didn't see that report. So I just wanted to know if you could just tell me where that report was from.
The one that I played, I'm not sure. I will have to go back and look. I know I had read it, the Washington Post and the New York Times. I can't say for sure right off top if they identified. I know they did not have a photograph of the victim. I don't even know how to describe the liar in this case. I know they did not have photographs of the female or her father in the articles that I read. The Washington Post, or the New York Times, the audio, it would take me a second to go back and look to see where the audio came from and if they have explicit identifying information about the racial classification of the daughter or her father. Let's see. It might even take me a second to go back and dig through and get the exact report. But if it takes me more than a second to do today, I'll just make sure that'll be item number one when we do our next program, just to make sure that we clear that up, because the racial classification is extremely important. Make sure that we have accurate information about that.
Yeah, because I say, man, if it was a white girl in Brownsville in the park getting raped, I mean, I don't care what kind of evidence they would have had, they was going to jail. I mean, I just didn't see it, you know?
That seemed to be the attitude that they had for a while until all of this came falling down. They were saying that it was just a replay of the Central Park Five, where they had the same thing. All you needed was Donald Trump to come out and say we need the death penalty and wilding in the park and blah blah blah. But other people were taking up that position for him and saying the exact same thing that they had said about the black non-white males from that time. Not all of them were black in 89, I think, with the Central Park Five case. But that was pretty much the sentiment when all of this broke, that, you know, they need to be Virginia Christian. We need the death penalty. They need to die like today, right now. And, you know, the whole nine. That was pretty much what I saw when this broke last month. I am struggling to find the exact audio. We'll just put that on top of the to-do list for next time. That way I'll be able to find it specifically, and I can shoot it to you so you can check out the audio clip and just the review, because I know they didn't have photographs. I don't think I've seen any photos or video, for that matter, of the female or her father.
Because I only say it because here in New York, you know, it was presented to us like this was in Brownsville, so this wasn't no white people, you know, so don't be alarmed. And this person could be potentially lying as well. From the start, it was like, you know, and there's some videotape footage that, you know, that the police are waiting for me. So I was wondering why it took so long to get to this point, because from the start, the kid's mother was like, yo, he got it all on tape. It was consensual or whatever. So I was, when they did speak to the man, like I said, he didn't, I wouldn't, if he committed a crime, they wouldn't have said Caucasian male. I mean, he would have been black or Spanish. They would have had another designation for him. So that's why I asked. But thank you for looking into that, Gus.
For sure. Appreciate the question. Always good to get the racial classification cleared up. I know, like, I remember this case. I remember when it came out, because they had, it was a lot of these types of incidents, like dark people being accused of raping and molesting, particularly white women, even though there's a question in this case. But I know there were the incidents that went down in Germany right on New Year's Day, where they said all these, you know, migrants have raped German women over the festivities. And same thing with that, where that started to fall apart, where it was, oh, well, it looks like some of the sexual terrorists were actually Germans. They were not refugees. And then some of it was, oh, it looks like maybe some of this is not even accurate at all. Maybe some people just made this up. And then they had a case specifically with, it looked to me like a white woman, where she had indeed lied, where they found out that this was all false, that she had just made all this up, and there was no rape at all. And this was stuff happening outside the U.S. and in other areas. So this was around the same time where a lot of these incidents were being reported. I know some of the original reports that I remember seeing before this, you know, was decided that none of this happened and they weren't going to charge anybody, that it seemed to be, like I said, Central Park Five all over again. We need the death penalty. They need to die like right now. Where's the lynch mob? That was the kind of, I don't remember there being much, although when they made the announcement last week, I do recall them saying that they had questions initially about the accuracy. Like I said, the father was drunk at the time of this incident, and so they weren't able to really get quality testimony from him about what happened, and some other things that they did have some questions from the very beginning about, you know, whether they were getting the a truthful story from these folks. But we'll put that at the top of the to-do list for next broadcast. Grant, I will assume folks are taken care of. I did see other people that called in who had a hand up, but I didn't hear anything. I don't know if they hit their mute button accidentally or whatever the case may be. Feel free to just jot it down. You can drop an email if you had a question or comment, something stood out. We should be back later in the week. If you would like to address something, we'll make time for it then. But we have done our 3 hours. Grand to hear from all the folks. Great questions. I hope folks got some constructive information, particularly for folks in the VA area. As I said, I did not know about this case at all. So always a great idea to study the geographic area where you are, so that you know a lot more information. People try to dispute you, anybody, white person, non-white person, and they try and dispute you and say that racism isn't an issue and why are you bringing this up now? You can just go to things that happened right here. We don't have to talk about things on the other side of the world, although that's helpful too. We can talk about things that happened right here on our block, at the school that we went to, the house that we're in, the neighborhood that we're in, the park down the road, whatever it happens to be, to just bring up, you know, accurate historical information to dispute all of that, and certainly Virginia has a lengthy, rich history of white terrorism. To know Nat Turner, Virginia Christian, even more recent things, Doug Wilder, Allen Iverson, lots and lots and lots and lots. With that, end of the Civil War, even. With that, we will wrap things up. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I would, again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. We really want to be able to make the best possible decisions at all times to keep ourselves safe, to defend ourselves. You really do not want to be caught out under the influence if you should be pulled over by Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, any of these other race soldiers. I mean, you really are putting yourself in an extremely weak position. We're already in a vulnerable position because of white supremacy. But if you are not thinking clear, man, it just becomes that much easier for them to totally destroy your life, even take your life. So really encourage, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not in the PayPal, drop me an email. We'll get you a physical mailing address. Thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported, kept us on the air for 7 years. I hope the broadcast has been helpful, getting you accurate information, clarity, better grasp of what racism is, how it works. With that, we should be back later in the week. We are starting the new book, Leonida McLean, A Foot in Each World, non-white author. Be great to read that book. I've been recommending it for a while. So we'll start it Friday, and we had multiple listeners who volunteered to read the book, black females who volunteered to read the book. She is a black female, Leonida McLean, so I thought it would be better to have a black female narrate. Unfortunately, all the people who volunteered do not have the book in hand, so we are kind of seeing, hoping books will be mailed on time, and that'll come through, but one way or another, that'll be the book that we're starting for Friday. So if folks want to go to the library or what have you to get a hard copy of the text in hand to follow along, we'll start that on Friday, the same normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have any other questions, gripes, complaints, suggestions, just drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. With that, thank you kindly for the folks tuning in, and we will be back soon. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.